The content of the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Now, it's time for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here, we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week, we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Call in between 12:30 and 1 p.m. on Sundays and present your case to our experts. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now, our host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is on, and we thank you once again for listening. Today we're tackling sexually transmitted diseases, STDs, with guest expert Dr. John Toney in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the USF College of Medicine here in Tampa, Florida. But first, this radio show and the free annual Focus on Females Healthcare Symposium, now the largest in the country with over 1,000 women during each of our last two events, with a combined 7,500 hours of education on those 2 days, is supported by the not-for-profit Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission to create an interactive, dynamic, community-based healthcare safety net, making you an expert on your personal medical needs. The result? Better partnering with your existing doctor, leading to more effective office visits, faster results, and a reduced economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. We save lives and protect families through the immediate impact of direct with the expert health education. And as mentioned, Dr. John Toney is with me today. Good afternoon, John.
Dr. Maskin, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Toney is professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Disease and International Medicine at the USF College of Medicine. He is director of the Southeast Region STD HIV Prevention Training Center, one of the CDC National Network of STD and HIV Prevention Training Centers, and the Director of Healthcare Epidemiology and Infectious Diseases Clinical Research at the James A. Haley Veterans Administration in Tampa. His research interests include clinical STD and HIV therapeutics, investigational anti-infectives, and vaccines. Dr. Toney received his MD as a charter class member from the Marshall University School of Medicine in 1981 and completed his medical residency and infectious disease fellowship at USF College of Medicine. Okay, so today we're going to tackle as many of these as we can. And again, we encourage listeners that have questions about these various different diseases. They may have heard something about it. And again, great opportunity to call. The phone number to call in with your question is 289-1860 here in Hillsborough County. That's 289-1860. Outside of Hillsborough County, it's toll-free, 877-969-8600. Once again, 877-969-8600. And those of you that are streaming live online can also use that phone number. So some of the topics, of course, that are in the category of STDs, and we'll run through these briefly. Chlamydia, genital HPV infection, genital herpes, bacterial vaginosis, gonorrhea, syphilis, trichomonas, and perhaps others, but those are, the major ones. Is that correct?
For the most part, yes.
And let's start with this question. What is the most common STD?
Well, interestingly enough, the most common STD isn't one that we typically follow with as accurate numbers as we would like. And it's really a one-celled organism that's called Trichomonas.
Okay.
Trichomonas has probably close to over 7 million new infections a year. It tends to be, in many individuals, more of a nuisance than what they would perceive as a problem. But women with Trichomonas, and men to some degree, if this is an infection that doesn't get diagnosed and treated, can put them at risk, especially women, if they become pregnant, for premature rupture membranes, premature delivery, and some other issues. But for the most part, it is kind of a nuisance, but there's quite a bit of Trichomonas out there, and you can pass it from male to female and occasionally from female to female.
Okay. And, of course, premature rupture of membranes puts the newborn at risk. Is there any pathology from a male position, any kind of pathology that can the Trichomonas can cause for the man?
Well, it may cause a little bit of what's called dysuria or mildness with a little bit of discomfort when you urinate. So it can cause absolutely no symptoms in males. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the problem with many of these infections. They can be asymptomatic in both men and women. So you might have it and really not know that you do have it.
And for the woman, they have a discharge?
Typically, they will have a discharge. It may or may not be noticeable. But to a healthcare provider, when they're doing a pelvic examination using speculum and looking inside of the vaginal area, what's very typical for you to see is a discharge that may be yellowish to grayish or greenish because of the white blood cells in it. And we talk about it looking frothy or bubbly appearance. Mm-hmm. There may be an odor associated with it that people call a musty or a fishy type of odor. That's not the only thing that can cause that odor, but that's one of the ones that's most common.
Okay. So aside from, of course, that'd be very uncomfortable for the woman. Aside from the premature rupture of membranes in the woman that's pregnant, is there any other pathology? Maybe she has dysuria or painful urinating as well.
It's a possibility, but more of it's going to be vaginitis.
Okay.
The other thing it can do is it can cause a slight amount of inflammation as well, and that can put you at risk with HIV infection if you get exposed to someone with HIV. So it will somewhat increase your risk of HIV infection if you encountered that.
Because it can also increase the risk of other STDs aside from HIV.
Well, I think it's the activity that puts you at risk, not necessarily the other infections.
Okay. All right. And as we move on to these various different STDs, if someone has a question on a topic we've already covered, by all means, call in and bring it up. So it's, again, very relaxed show today. And let's talk about Trichomonas, of course, is a parasite. Are there other parasites that are in this list or that are STDs?
Very few. Mm-hmm. In the United States, really not so many. Occasionally in other countries, you might find a few, some amoeba, but generally not quite so much in the STD realm.
Let's go to chlamydia.
Well, you go from something that was extremely common, probably the most common transmissible, sexually transmitted infection, to one that we do follow. It is a reportable disease in all 50 states, and we know that there's almost 2.3 million cases of chlamydia that are out there. Now, that's what's reported.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is that, again, a lot of men and women don't have symptoms with this disease. They don't get diagnosed and they don't get treated. So the assumption is there's more out there. We just don't know exactly how much. But we do have that number that we do follow, which is a lot.
Absolutely. Now, what are the common symptoms that those of the individuals that have symptomatic chlamydia, what are the things whereby they should sit up, take notice, and perhaps get evaluated by their doctor?
Well, in women, it can manifest as a vaginal discharge. So in women that have a vaginal discharge, you know, one of the things I think that we'd like to try and treat it ourselves. The one thing that women should never do is douche.
Okay.
Douching is something that's going to put you at risk for other things, but that really won't help. So that's one thing not to do. The second thing that many women might do is to consider going and buying an over-the-counter candida treatment, a yeast treatment, thinking it might be a vaginal yeast infection. That may or may not work in some cases. It works if yeast is there. It won't work if yeast isn't there. The problem is there's really not a good over-the-counter test for these to tell you what it could be and what it couldn't be. So you really need someone to look at that discharge and to do some testing to find out. So chlamydia can have a discharge. Usually it's in the cervix area from the opening into the cervix up into the uterus, the cervical os area. Os just means mouth. And you can see a mucoid type of discharge, or it may have a little bit of pus in it, and we would call that simplistically mucopurulent discharge.
Okay.
That would make, I think, most individuals a little anxious. But the other thing is that while you're doing that exam, you can test for both gonorrhea and chlamydia with testing now that looks at trying to find the DNA of these organisms. The term that's used is called nucleic acid amplification testing, big fancy name.
PCR?
Yeah, we call it NAT testing. They do different ways, PCR, SDA, TMA. There's a lot of different names that are thrown out, but it's just the mechanism that they do the testing. And it's really nice because if you are having just urethral symptoms, so it may be uncomfortable or burn when you pee, the testing now has been validated to use even on urine specimens. So something you were going to get rid of anyway, your provider may ask you to pee in a cup. They're going to take that first amount that comes out. You need to not have urinated within a couple of hours for it to be really accurate. But it's a really nice test, and it makes it nice for men because in the old days, we used to have to put a swab, even though it's a small swab, into the urethra, which is not comfortable. And someone who's not uncomfortable anyway, they're not really excited about that concept.
Right. So are we seeing more gynecologists using this type of approach for diagnoses in the setting of a woman with discharge?
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that the CDC recommends that in young women between the ages of 15 through 24 that you get tested for chlamydia when you get your pap smears.
And of course, worst case scenario for a woman with untreated chlamydia can cause pelvic inflammatory disease.
That's true. About 10 to 20% of undiagnosed chlamydia and gonorrhea is also associated with pelvic inflammatory disease. It's
and that can lead to sterility. That's the point.
It can lead to three different things, which is really concerning. If you have PID, one episode of PID will increase your chance of infertility about 15 to 24%, so roughly about 25%. Three or more episodes of PID can increase your chance of being infertile 40 to 75%. So that's going to be an issue. The second is...
Let me back up and ask a question on that. If you have a woman has a case of chlamydia, develops pelvic inflammatory disease, and of course, the as you mentioned, the incidence of infertility from that is up to 25%, and that's through scarring of the fallopian tubes, for example?
Correct.
Then, and you said if they have three episodes, now if it's untreated, can that same organism then cause another bout of PID? Or you're saying it's three independent episodes?
Three separate infections. Right.
So assuming that the first one is ultimately treated.
Right.
Okay. So potentially up to 75% risk of infertility at that point. Okay.
Yeah. With three or more, again, it increases. Mm-hmm. The second thing that is unfortunately associated with PID is having what's called an ectopic pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Normally, the pregnancy is going to be in the uterus. Well, ectopic means it's outside of the uterus. So you can have a pregnancy that develops in the fallopian tube. It's not supposed to be there. Your anatomy won't let that progress in a natural fashion. And what you can get is separation of the placenta and hemorrhage in women, and it may be not survivable, or even worst case scenario, that it doesn't even get into the tube and you start having the fetus developing inside the abdominal cavity, which really is just extremely risky.
So ultimately, it puts the life of the woman at risk.
Correct. The third thing that probably hasn't been discussed as much, but I think a lot of OBGYNs see some of the results of what we see with PID is chronic pelvic pain syndrome.
Okay.
Because you're getting infected material spilling out into the abdominal cavity, and that causes a lot of inflammation. That's why, you know, women, when they get sick enough, will come in and they have abdominal discomfort in some fashion or another. So the problem is with that inflammation, you can get scarring internally, and that causes pain, and that pain may be there pretty much all the time.
So that's interesting. So what we're saying is that with the chronic pelvic pain, the setting of a chlamydia infection, the inflammation, the discharge can actually develop in the pelvic cavity.
Yeah, that's true.
And that could affect the ovaries, for example.
It may. It may cause what are called adhesions, mm-hmm. and that's just areas of fibrinous scarring tissue that attaches to inside of the cavity of the abdominal wall to the peritoneum. Mm-hmm. And can attach to bowel, it can attach, you know, to other organs, and that pulling and tugging on those can certainly be uncomfortable.
So that potentially can lead to problems with your bowels?
Correct.
As well as the ability, so you may wind up having constipation issues, and et cetera?
You can, and there are some people that if the adhesion gets around the wrong piece of bowel, you can get a partial or a full bowel obstruction, wouldn't be able to move your bowels because there's no place for them to go,
okay.
Which is a medical emergency.
Well, this is very important information, and we're going to take a quick break here now and come back with more. The phone number to call in with questions is 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Everywhere else, 877-969-8600. We're talking about STDs with Dr. John Tony from USF's College of Medicine. Be right back.
Let's take a listen inside Bill McCollum's campaign strategy meeting.
We gotta attack Rick Scott now.
Tried that. Didn't work.
But it's Bill McCollum's turn to be governor and our turn to cash in. Just make it up.
We already tried that, too.
Well, do it again. It's not like it needs to be true.
Well, we could try to convince them he's for abortion.
Poor Bill McCollum, a 30-year career politician embarrassing himself with false personal attacks on Rick Scott. The facts. McCollum received money from abortion providers in each of his 12 congressional campaigns. He even took money from Planned Parenthood lobbyists. As a lobbyist himself, McCollum's firm was paid $100,000 to represent abortion providers. McCollum supported spending tax dollars on embryonic stem cell research, creating life simply to destroy it. Rick Scott is pro-life, always has been. He's pro-life because of principle, not politics.
Political advertisement paid for and approved by Rick Scott. Republican for governor.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit FocusOnFemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
For the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is ophthalmologist and eye surgeon Dr. Stephen L. Maskin. Dr. Maskin is the medical director of the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, the proud sponsor of today's show. At the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, Dr. Maskin specializes in solving difficult dry eye and cornea disorders with patients traveling from over 35 states and 5 continents for his evaluation. He has written a best-selling, award-winning book, Reversing Dry Eye Syndrome, published by Yale University Press.
Dr. Maskin manages dry eye disorders using, when needed, innovative medical and surgical therapies, including the use of placenta-derived amniotic membrane, a new patent-pending natural eye lubricant to provide relief for dry eye sufferers, an exciting new procedure to unblock obstructed tear glands, and a topical cure for eye surface cancer. Dr. Maskin has successfully managed difficult dry eye cases for over 20 years and is board-certified, fellowship-trained, and a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and American Academy of Ophthalmology. He has been selected a best doctor in America every year from 2000 through 2010. And as an America's top ophthalmologist by Consumers Research Council of America, we hope the Focus on Females education programs, including this show, will help you and your family find the health care that works for you. Focus on Females believes in saving lives and protecting families. And please visit drmaskin.com. And if you have not found relief for your painful red, dry eyes, come in to see Dr. Maskin at the Dry Eye and Cornea Treatment Center, where comfortable eyes lead to restored lives.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, we're back with Dr. John Tony, Infectious Disease Division of USF College of Medicine. We're talking about sexually transmitted diseases. We've talked about trichomonas. Now we're talking about chlamydia. Now, chlamydia is considered an intracellular parasite, isn't that correct?
That's true. It is a bacteria, but okay. It has to get inside of cells to replicate. And the reason for that is that even though they're bacteria, they don't have the machinery inside. They don't have mitochondria to provide energy. So they have to get inside of our cells to use the energy in our cells to replicate. And that's what causes a lot of the inflammation, because eventually it's going to cause those cells to die or to rupture and release more of the replication parts of chlamydia, the elementary bodies. They do that, and when they do that, they don't really cause a huge amount of pain. It's not as bad as, let's say, gonorrhea in men. When men get gonorrhea in the urethral area, that's when they tell you, I pee glass, I'm peeing fire, because it's really uncomfortable in most men. But even in men, 10 to 15% gonorrhea is totally asymptomatic.
Wow.
So that's a problem with these, and especially with chlamydia, because it doesn't cause as much inflammation. But it can. It can cause symptoms.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because, of course, as an ophthalmologist, sometimes we see conjunctivitis, chronic conjunctivitis, and chlamydia is one of the diagnoses in the differential of chronic conjunctivitis. But it can be difficult to diagnose objectively. And back in training, we were taught that we have to get a scraping of the conjunctival epithelium, and that if you don't get sufficient number of cells, your yield would be inadequate to diagnose these inclusion bodies. And so it can be challenging, but you have to think of it to be able to diagnose it. And I know we had a conversation before about the state of the art as far as diagnosing chlamydia as a lab test. What's the status of that?
Well, the old way was exactly what you said, was you had to get a lot of cells, because that's where most of the chlamydia were. You had to put them on a cell media. It couldn't be on an artificial media like an agar plate, because they won't grow there. It was really time-consuming. It's expensive. Most labs don't do that anymore, because they just don't have the personnel and the expense and the time. So as you've heard with a lot of other things on TV, you know, people are looking at doing the amplified DNA test. So DNA testing is here with at least realistically, with three of these things now. You can actually do what's called nucleic acid amplification tests, or NAT testing, which is not to be confused with GNAT, the NAT that buzzes around your head. But NAT testing is really helpful with gonorrhea and chlamydia. You can test it from the urethra in both men and women. You can do it from the cervical area in women. But again, you can have people basically urinate in a cup and send that to the laboratory, and if it's done correctly, again, you need to wait usually a couple of hours after they've urinated to get a really good specimen, and it can be very helpful. The test isn't FDA approved in the oral area or the rectal area. However, the CDC is starting to validate a lot of the reference laboratories that are out there. so that we will be able to use it there. And I have a sneaking suspicion you'll probably end up being able to get it in the eye at some point.
You bring up the oral area. Can chlamydia cause a oropharyngeal infection?
It can. It's probably not quite as common as getting gonorrhea, but even that's not quite so common in oropharyngeal areas. So, but it is one of those things that, you know, there are a lot of young individuals out there that say, you know, if I have oral sex or anal sex, that's not really sex, because sex is if you get pregnant by it, that's true sex. The problem is that, unfortunately, these bacteria, viruses, protozoans, and fungi don't know that, and they can cause problems in the mouth, in the rectal area, as well as in the genital area.
Right. The old quote is, diseases don't read the textbooks.
Not very well, they don't.
All right. Well, good. Now, as far as the treatment for chlamydia, that's pretty straightforward, is it not?
Yeah, it is. One of the things that had come out several years ago was a great drug, azithromycin. It's similar to erythromycin, except that it lasts longer in the body. So one of the things that we still use, and it's extremely effective for chlamydia, is giving a gram of azithromycin. One-time dose usually takes care of chlamydia infections.
That's by mouth.
By mouth. Mm-hmm. An alternative is doxycycline, but you'd have to take, there are 100 milligram capsules, you take two of them, one twice a day, generally for 7 days.
Okay. Now, how can chlamydia be prevented?
Well, chlamydia, number one is knowing your partners as much as you can, and that means having mutually monogamous partners, so your partner is only having sex with you and you're only having sex with them. If you're not sure about if they've ever been exposed to chlamydia or if you've ever been exposed to chlamydia, the second thing is get tested. Mm-hmm. Third thing is that if that hasn't been done, you can use condoms. They do work quite well for actually many of the sexually transmitted infections. And I know that people sometimes don't like condoms. Sometimes guys will say, you know, that they're too big for condoms. But condoms come in a wide variety of sizes. They come in a wide variety of sensitivities now. So there are a lot more things than there were 10, 15 years ago that are out there that people need to just try. And more often than not, people find something that works for them.
Okay. Let's move on to genital herpes, which, of course, is a virus.
It is a virus. It's a fairly common virus. If you look nationwide, about a little over 16%, which is about 1 out of 6 individuals in the age group of 14 through 49 years of age will have been exposed to genital herpes. Now, there's two different kinds of herpes. There's what we call HSV, which is this herpes simplex virus, HSV1 and HSV2. Generally, HSV1 is associated with ulcerations and sores in your mouth, and people get that, you know, from contact, kissing, or generally oral-to-oral contact. However, you can get HSV1 in the genital area if you're having oral genital contact. The other way around, you can have HSV2, which is more common in the genital area, but occasionally can cause issues in the oral area. So depending on the contact, you can get them in either of the areas. It's a very common infection. It tends to favor women more than men, interestingly enough.
Do we know why yet?
Well, I think some of it is probably surface area related, and you know, some may have to do with whether the male is circumcised or not. There are a lot of issues that people discuss, but usually it's going to be because of unprotected sex.
Okay.
The problem with herpes is that we used to, when we were in school, we were taught, oh, it's easy. Herpes is a group of little blisters. That we call vesicles, you know. So you have this group of little, as people like to tell me, a group of little water blisters, and they break down into these ulcers. Then they start drying up, crust over, and that was what we were taught was an episode of genital herpes. That probably occurs in people who truly have herpes maybe 10 to 15% of the time. What we've learned from a failed vaccine study that was out, looking at a vaccine study for herpes, and there are some that are in the works, still investigating that as something that hopefully we'll have, but that other manifestations are these little linear ulcers That there are different names out there in the literature. People talk about a knife cut lesion because it does hurt. And in some ways, it's kind of like a paper cut, mm-hmm. but in the genital area, if you will. So if you have that, that could be actually be herpes. There are some individuals who have said, you know, I've never had herpes. I'm sure I've never had any of that. I've not had these knife cut or some people call them haircut lesions because they thought it was due to pubic hair and mm-hmm. that caused irritation. But then they end up getting immune suppressed for whatever the reason. They either get HIV, they get on high-dose steroids, chemotherapy, whatever, and then they have an outbreak. And it may not be in the genital area. It can also be on the backside. It can be in the gluteal area, and most people wouldn't necessarily...
On skin.
On skin. Occasionally, it's even confused with herpes zoster, shingles, because, you know, that wouldn't be exactly where the person would expect it. They are telling their provider, I never had herpes in the past. But if you culture that, or you can do the same kind of amplified testing, you can do PCR testing for herpes and find out that it actually is herpes. So we've learned a lot about it. And the other thing we've learned is that you can't actually transmit this and have absolutely no symptoms if you have herpes. You can asymptomatically shed. So that it's really made it more complicated for providers because most people, when they get genital herpes, want to know when's it safe to have sex and when's it not. And nobody wants to hear never. But there are times when it's safer than when it's not.
Safer meaning if there's no visible lesions?
Yes, absolutely.
But it's not 100%.
Not 100%. And people will actually shed. Different people shed on different days. You just can't predict, unfortunately. We don't have a good test for that yet.
How about there's something called suppressive therapy. Does that give the individuals more confidence about not shedding?
Well, it certainly can. And there was a wonderful study that was done at the University of Washington, published in the New England Journal of Medicine back in 2004 from Drs. Larry Corey and Anna Wald. And what they did was they looked at a grouping, a cohort of individuals where one, it was heterosexual couples, where one partner had herpes, the other one didn't. And what they did was they put the person that had herpes on suppressive therapy and encouraged the use of condoms. And what they found in the 8 months of follow-up was significant decrease, 75% decrease in the transmission of this infection. So suppressive therapy can help with that.
How about the complications of genital herpes? Now, obviously, it's a complication, a potential complication in the woman who has a newborn about ready to be delivered.
Yeah, and that's a great question because that is one of the things that is kind of anxiety-producing in women is usually they have a history of genital herpes. Now they're worried they're going to pass it to their child. There was just last year, really, again, a New England Journal of Medicine, review.
Hang on a second before we go further. And what happens to the child if the child's born vaginally and contracts the herpes, the issue is much more serious than having a case of genital herpes because that herpetic infection in the newborn can be life-threatening for the newborn.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And it depends on, you know, what it infects or what it's occurring in the newborn. But to go back to women that have a history of genital herpes, unless they have a visible outbreak at the time of delivery, the chance of them passing it on to their child is less than 1%. But if you don't have herpes and you get pregnant, if you get herpes during pregnancy, especially the last 3 months of pregnancy, you have approximately a 50% chance of passing it on to your child.
So the initial episode of herpes is much more exaggerated, exuberant.
Yeah, it's more robust.
Robust, yes.
And that is a concern during pregnancy. So, you know, one of the recommendations that are really being made to women who are looking to become pregnant or that are pregnant is it is a test that you can get. They're what are called type-specific herpes antibody tests. And there are several companies that make them, but it's the type-specific ones because they measure a glycoprotein on the outside of the virus. We used to have these herpes tests. They're very crude antigen tests, and they just weren't very helpful. One other thing that I would just mention, because it gets really confusing for people, is there is what's called an IgM test. An IgM is an antibody that's made early in infections. The problem is that it can cross-react with lots of different tests. And in herpes and in some other conditions, it's really not very useful at all. Okay. And we just wouldn't recommend that. But it's still in a lot of laboratories, and some providers still get it. And it's confusing. What do I do with this information? We would recommend that people not get an IgM test for herpes. But this, the long-term antibody, the IgG-type antibody, with these tests, with the type-specific tests, are very helpful and will tell you if you've had an exposure or not. If you've had an exposure to herpes but never had, again, these manifestations that we talked about, that still goes back to if you don't have an outbreak at the time of delivery, you should be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing that, it makes, you know, the obstetricians a little bit more cautious to make sure they take every precaution available, which I'm sure the vast majority do anyway. We get very anxious when you're bringing in a new child into the world, just to make sure that nothing goes wrong with that. The other part of the news is if you don't and your partner does have herpes, or if they refuse to get tested, I would assume that they do, just even if you don't know.
You have to assume. Mm.
And that means that for the rest of that pregnancy, you probably shouldn't have any sexual contact.
Mm-hmm.
Some people argue with condoms, and condoms can help, but condoms may not be 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the risk. Mm-hmm. And that's one way you can try and risk reduce, is right. to get information.
And if there is an active outbreak during the last few months, then, of course, the child would be delivered cesarean rather than go through the birth canal.
If there's an active infection, some individuals will still do it. Occasionally, you know, people will deliver if it's not a big outbreak. Usually, if there's any concern, the child gets given intravenous acyclovir. If you do that, it significantly decreases the risk mm-hmm. that anything bad is going to happen to that child. And that's what this article that came out last year did a really nice review of the literature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also a nice article because for practitioners, it tells you a lot of myths and the realities, the old kind of thoughts, and really what we know now.
I remember when I came to town back in 91, I was early on asked to see a case over in at St. Joe's in the neonatal area of a newborn. A little premature, both corneas were opaque, and it was a case of herpes disease that the neonate developed passing through the birth canal. So it could be a devastating thing to a newborn. We talked about before how it could take its life, so it's, you know, these are important considerations to discuss with your obstetrician. Any other complications of general herpes other than what we talked about so far?
Well, you know, I think the biggest complication is just the anxiety and, you know, the change in personality that people get. I mean, they get upset, you know, and with most of these infections, people are not anxious to hear that for a variety of reasons. The bacterial ones, the vast majority, we can cure. The viral ones, we can suppress. Even the protozoan ones and the yeast things, we can certainly treat those and get rid of those. But it makes people, you know, go back and ask questions. Who did I get this from? How did I get it?
Right.
And a lot of times your practitioner isn't going to be able to tell you who you got this from. It wouldn't be legal for us to go and stand outside your window at night and look inside to see who's doing what.
But it doesn't increase your risk of, say, cervical cancer as, say, papillomavirus can do.
Well, there was a paper looking at perhaps, you know, chlamydia as being a cofactor. That might be a possibility with long-term untreated chlamydia. We know that in our world of infectious diseases and people that get chronic infections, occasionally around some of those areas they can develop cancers. Usually it's going to be like with a bone infection with osteomyelitis. They usually drain to the outside unless that they're on treatment. And that drainous sinus tract, occasionally you'll see a squamous cell carcinoma develop. So that might be, but the vast majority of these seem to be due to HPV. And at least cervical cancer, cervical dysplasia. Okay.
Let's talk about syphilis, and if we have time later, we can come back to general HPV or papillomavirus. And you know what? Before we do that, let's take a quick break. We are talking with Dr. John Toney, USF College of Medicine, on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Be right back with more.
Barney Frank and his friends in the House and Senate Finance Committees have done it.
I declare the bill passed.
They've agreed on a banking reform bill that's supposed to prevent future meltdowns.
Like the one that we're still recovering from.
But without addressing the housing bubble and the problems at Fannie and Freddie, how can it possibly work?
This means the economy is going to continue to be in a tighter credit environment for longer.
Now, more than ever, is the banking reform bill too big to fail? Talk Radio 860 WGUL.
The St. Petersburg Area Chamber of Commerce will recognize local premier businesses and nonprofit agencies at their Outstanding Business of the Year Awards Dinner, sponsored by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Florida and the St. Petersburg Times. This Wednesday evening, 6 o'clock at the St. Petersburg Hilton. Come show your support for our outstanding local businesses. For more information and to purchase tickets, call 727-388-2918. That's 727-388-2918. Online at business.stpete.com.
Victimized by illegal immigration, Arizona is fighting to protect its citizens. Instead of enforcing the law and strengthening the border, the Obama administration is encouraging an irresponsible boycott. Hi, it's Mike Gallagher. Our friends at Town Hall have created ArizonaStrong.com. Log on today to sign our free petition and show your support for the rule of law in Arizona. Say no to states and cities that want to boycott Arizona. Keep Arizona strong. Join with us and declare your solidarity at ArizonaStrong.com. That's ArizonaStrong.com.
So exciting!
The best military exhibit I've ever seen.
Very educational.
They're talking about the Armed Forces Military Museum in Largo, the largest collection of military memorabilia in Florida. Each diorama bringing the past to life with the sights and sounds of battles that made history. Dedicated with respect to those who've served our country faithfully. Learn more at www.armedforcesmuseum.com. That's www.armedforcesmuseum.com.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit FocusOnFemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, once again, we are covering sexually transmitted diseases. Dr. John Tony, USF School of Medicine. Phone number to call in, 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Okay, John, let's move on to syphilis. Syphilis, also known as Louis. What is it, and how common is it?
Well, syphilis is a really old infection. It's been described for, maybe a millennium or at least. It's caused by bacteria. It's actually a little different kind of bacteria. It's called spiral type of bacteria,
spirochete.
If you will, spirochete. Mm. The name for this is Treponema pallidum, and there are other spirochetes that people have probably heard of, at least the diseases that they cause. One that causes Lyme disease, another one occasionally people will hear of it, leptospirosis, which is usually found in animals' urines. Well, syphilis is a disease realistically only of humans, that we are the reservoir for this and we pass it among ourselves. We have known about syphilis for a long time, and the biggest boons for the treatment of syphilis were at the end of World War II, basically when penicillin started becoming mass-produced. Penicillin still works great for this infection. Even low amounts of it in your blood can work very well. We also had testing that was done. The testing has been the biggest issue with this disease because we still need to draw blood, and the testing isn't quite as accurate as we would like. People are trying to come up with newer, better tests, but they're slow in coming into clinical research into the market. But using testing, using penicillin treatment, and what you have to use is a long-acting form of penicillin, because these spirochetes take a good 33, 36 hours to replicate, unlike something like gonorrhea that only takes 30 minutes. So that penicillin has to hang around a long time. So we use what's called benzathine penicillin, and it's usually given as an intramuscular injection.
But tell me this.
Yes.
What can syphilis do to you?
Well, what it does is, number one, it'll make your life miserable, generally because it isn't viewed as much of an issue. We've seen a big diminution in syphilis over the years. There was a little peak of it between 1989 and 1991. The rates have been going down. Unfortunately, over the last 3 years, the rates have been going up, first in the group of men who are having sex with other men. But most recently, it started going back up in women. There were a little over 13,000 cases of syphilis in 2008. It increased in 1 year's duration in women 36%, and in that same time period, 15% in men. So we do have to worry more about it in women. It generally starts out as a little bump that erodes into an ulcer.
On the skin.
On the skin, okay. But you may or may not see it. And in women, if it's in the labial area, you can see it. It can be in the vagina, it could be on the cervix, and you're not going to see that.
Because it's usually painless.
It usually is painless, unless it gets secondarily infected. Mm-hmm. You can see a syphilitic, and it's called a chancre. The sore is called a chancre. You can see those even in the oral area, but it can look like some other things. And if it doesn't hurt, doesn't bleed, doesn't draw your attention to it, you may or may not even recognize it.
That's called primary syphilis.
That is called primary syphilis. Okay. Now, there's a period where that you don't have any clinical signs or symptoms, so there's no manifestations of this that you would see. That's called latent syphilis. Mm-hmm. And that may occur right after primary syphilis, and then you'd go into what's called secondary syphilis, where that you do have more clinical manifestations, and the most common one is a rash. The rash generally kind of looks in a way like a coin, if you will, and the old term for that was nickel-dime lesions, because they were kind of scaly, they were round. You can see them on the palms of the hand, soles of the feet. You don't always have to see that, but they're commonly on there, and they're unusual that most infections, if they're associated with rash, don't necessarily cause it on the palms mm-hmm. and the soles of the feet. So you might see that. You can see some patchy hair loss. You can see some things in the genital area, both men and women, that kind of look like genital herpes, I'm sorry, of HPV, the genital warts in those areas. And they're actually called the flat warts of secondary syphilis. So syphilis, unfortunately, can be confused with all kinds of things.
It's a great masquerader.
It is a great masquerader. So you may or may not see clinical manifestations. You can even see some swollen lymph glands associated with this. Some people will find that they may have a headache, they just don't feel well, they have that term that we call malaise, it's just a feeling of illness that it's hard to describe.
And the eye can get involved from front to back.
Oh, sure, absolutely, and that is something that we do see occasionally in people getting all kinds of manifestation in the eye that you're very familiar with. So we do see that, and in people who are untreated, who are not immune compromised, especially we do worry about people with HIV in this disease, mm-hmm. Then they go on to what's called late syphilis. And there are some manifestations of that, but that's become actually pretty uncommon in the United States because we've got the disease down, and we use antibiotics to treat things, and usually in a duration that if it's a penicillin, and perhaps even some cephalosporins might actually treat this disease. And there is some data that even using azithromycin might be an alternative to treat this. So there are a lot of things that can happen. The problem we worry about in women in particular is that this is one bacteria that can actually cross the placenta. Gonorrhea, chlamydia, herpes you encounter if you're the child being born while you're giving birth, while you're going through the birth canal. This one can cross the placenta and get into the child while it's developing.
Mm.
And we do really worry about that.
How about also neurosyphilis?
Oh, absolutely. That's one of the things we do worry about, especially in immune compromise. We know that this bacteria can get into spinal fluid during any stage of syphilis. But most people have a pretty good immune system in their brain. So we don't generally see that, but all it takes is a little quirk in your immune system, mm-hmm. and that might be an issue. We do see that more in people who are immune compromised, especially of HIV.
So this is something, if it gets in your spinal cord, your brain, it's potentially lethal.
Over a period of time, it certainly...
Without treatment.
It can. In the past, when there was no treatment, it was a common cause of insanity and ultimately death.
Mm.
But, you know, we really don't see it progressing to that stage now because more people are starting to think about it, and the treatment is either going to be, if it's neurosyphilis, with intravenous penicillin.
Mm-hmm.
And there are ways to do that, either in hospital and sometimes outside the hospital. But generally, it's thinking about it for individuals because it can be something that you may not see or may be confused. And sometimes we'll see people that, you know, in the summertime and it's hot and they have a rash.
Mm.
And what do they tell you? It's a heat rash.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the rash with syphilis is a heat rash, but it's what I always term a heat of passion rash. And we can cure that one with penicillin. The other ones may need something else.
Let me ask you, because we're running out of time, let's make a few comments about gonorrhea. Compare it to syphilis. Syphilis obviously is a systemic disease, can affect just about any tissue in the body. How about gonorrhea?
Well, gonorrhea has a wide variety of manifestations. Generally, again, most of these have issues in the genital area. In men, it is, again, probably 85 to 95% of men are going to have this as a urethral discharge. One of the kind of street terms for it is called the drip because it is a very prolific discharge. In most individuals. In some, maybe not as much, and it's usually, it looks purulent. It looks like pus mm-hmm. in a lot of individuals, but not always. But it's extremely uncomfortable in men. But again, that 10 to 15% may not have symptoms. Women generally aren't very symptomatic with gonorrhea.
Mm-hmm.
And when they do, it's much later, and they may manifest their gonorrhea as pelvic inflammatory disease.
Okay.
So that's one issue in women is they may not get as symptomatic. The symptoms may be very, you know, nebulous. You know, mm-hmm. is it gas? Is it, mm-hmm. you know, appendicitis? Is it this or that? We do worry about gonorrhea, especially in women, especially during pregnancy, because, again, at the time of vaginal delivery that, you know, the bacteria, the gonococci, can get into the eye in the newborn and cause problems. So can chlamydia in newborns as well. And that's why we try and treat them within an hour after delivery with a topical antibiotic, erythromycin, that would keep this from happening.
Excellent. The other thing is with gonorrhea, sometimes in ophthalmology clinics we see so-called hyperacute conjunctivitis where the pus just as you mentioned, drip from the urethra, the same thing from the eye.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that is complicated. And on the occasions that you know practitioners see this, we always encourage them to have an ophthalmologist see them. The dose of... the antibiotic that we would recommend is an injectable antibiotic that's called ceftriaxone. The dose is higher for that because it is the eye, and you do worry more about some of the penetration
blinding
into the tissues and blindness that you can see from that.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. We only have a couple minutes left. Let's summarize, take-home message for our listeners regarding STDs.
Well, I think the biggest message is a couple of things. Number one is be aware. The second is to get yourself tested. You know, if you don't know, if you've had, you know, more than one sexual partner or if your partner has more than one sexual partner, there is, if you go to the CDC's website and it's cdc.gov, G-O-V, and then /STD, you'll find a lot of links. And one of them is to STD awareness. And there's a link to GYT, getting yourself tested, that MTV and others have put into making people more aware. Because these things can be asymptomatic. You don't know what you're getting. You don't know what you're giving.
Excellent. And as we discussed already today, number one, it potentially, depending upon what STD a person may have, it could be lethal. If not lethal, they can certainly render a woman infertile. So there's potentially very serious things. You don't want to miss them. Have a great week. We'll see.